welcome back. We have filmmaker Douglas Robbins in the studio. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Sonia.
So your film debate team obviously follows some debate teams. Why did you decide to make a film about debate?
I debated for Berkeley in the early 90s and thought it was a really fascinating subculture that at the time had not been explored. I actually even wrote a novel about debate that never got published. But when I went to law school and then eventually came out and became a lawyer, I was still looking for some sort of creative outlet. Practicing the law is not the most creatively fulfilling sort of work you could imagine. I know there's lots of Law and Order episodes to the contrary, but it's not like that. So the idea of the documentary sort of came about soon after I got laid off my job, and me and a good friend of mine were very disillusioned about having worked so hard to achieve march toward the careers we were marching toward, and found they were not as promised. It wasn't Law and Order, and it wasn't LA Law, and it was something else entirely. And it was sort of like a nothing to lose situation. The price for video production equipment came radically down, and for about the price of a used Corolla at the time, you could get up and running and make yourself a documentary.
What do you think is the driving force that sort of gets these kids into debate in the first place?
I think for a lot of the kids, especially the ones that stick with it for a long time, they're what you would think they are. They're failures in many other ways. They didn't make it to on the basketball team. They're not the best looking, most charming kid at school. If they were, they'd be popular and be doing that. And instead, they embrace the thing that God has given them, and that appears to be the ability to articulate and make arguments. And it's a place, a world where they feel comfortable, and they can grab authority and power because people finally listen to what they have to say, and it becomes intoxicating.
Now, I can't complete this interview without asking about how this whole like rapid fire debate style where they just speed talk for 6 minutes. How did this start? Because as I was watching them, I'm like, okay, I knew people on the debate team in high school, but I don't think this is what they were doing.
Should just back up and say, this is a particular kind of debate. It's called policy debate. And in this forum, the reason why there's rapid-fire speeches, these speeches go from, people estimate, between 300 and 400 words per minute. And the reason for that is because there's a limited amount of speech time. There's 8 to 9 minutes in constructive speeches, and then about, I think, 6 or 7 minutes in rebuttal speeches. And during this time, you have a limited amount of time to respond to your opponent's arguments. So if your opponents can make a multitude of arguments, to which you fail to respond to, those unresponded to arguments are called dropped arguments. And a dropped argument is a conceded argument, meaning no matter how dumb the argument was, it is counted against you. So each side has an incentive to make as many arguments as possible in a debate as a way to hopefully, it's called outspread your opponent. It becomes an issue of quantity over quality at some point.
So, how is this what you were practicing when you were in debate?
When I was doing debate in the early 90s, yeah, it's called the spread or the gut spread, and it was a pretty common tactic. It actually arose in the 70s. Arguments were more rhetorical; they were slower; they were more of sort of what you would think of as classical Aristotelian arguments, rhetoric. And by the mid 70s. It had sped up. By the early 80s and probably by the late 80s, things had gotten a little bit out of hand. Unfortunately, the result of the spread of this speed argumentation is that it's made debate this entirely separate and alien subculture that the outside world can't access. They can't access because of the technical jargon, and they can't access because of the speed. And unfortunately, because of those two elements, the activity has relegated itself to even more obscurity and more irrelevance than it would otherwise have been anyways.
Sort of like cattle auctioneering, where it's just
the... Like cattle auctioneering, exactly. But but making, you know, less sense to an outside observer.
Well, and that's interesting that you bring that up, because one of the subjects in the film, they talk to his parents, and he, when he was a child, actually wanted to be an auctioneer.
That's Aaron Hardy, and he did want to be an auctioneer as a child. Aaron Hardy's an interesting kid, interesting topic.
you can't leave it at that.
The Aaron Hardy story, in some ways, I think, is the focus of the entire documentary. And because he is obsessed with debate, I think more than anybody else is who's in that documentary, it becomes his life. And we parallel and compare and contrast him with another character in the film, a top star debater who debated in the 1960s. His name is Mike Miller. He is considered perhaps one of the most winning debaters of all times, having won 22 tournaments over the course of his career, winning 9 tournaments in 1969 alone and coming in second at 4 more. He was in the final round of every single tournament he competed in 1969. But when he went to the national tournament, he came up against Harvard. The Harvard team, which was, by the way, coached by Larry Tribe, the famous constitutional scholar from Harvard, and lost. He came in second place at the national tournament. And ever since then, he has bemoaned that loss and lamented the loss, and to this day criticizes himself for having failed, as you say, failed in the most important round of his life. And he attributes a lot of his current failures in life to that round. And by the way, he's not a failure by any stretch of the imagination, but it's an interesting compare and contrast between one's self-perception of success and failure versus the outside world's, or a more objective assessment of success and failure. And you find that there's a kind of bad reality testing that goes on when one makes an obsession of an activity, of any activity perhaps, but certainly of an activity like debate that arguably has even less relevance than other kinds of sporting activities like baseball, basketball, or soccer.
Well, I think something that I questioned while I was watching it is, what is this preparing you for in life, really? I mean, I see how debate as an institution would prepare you for, you know, public speaking and actually coming up with cohesive arguments to, you know, be Barack Obama or whoever. But I'm not seeing that that's where these kids are going. So what do you think is, what is this sort of building them towards?
Right. I think you're absolutely right to make the Barack Obama comparison. If Barack Obama was doing debate, he would not be doing policy, high-speed policy debate. He'd be doing the slower, rhetorical, persuasive debate that does exist. It's called parley. It's called parley debate. That's a more sort of rhetorical and slower kind of debate. This high-speed debate is really less about persuasion. It's not about one party persuading an outside party or adapting one's arguments to fit the listener's persuasion, something that Barack Obama is a master at. But to defend policy debate, it is actually a fairly good forum for learning how to do very fast, fairly deep analysis, a fairly sophisticated analysis, political analysis. And it's also fairly good at training you to do research and to understand global events.
And rapid-fire speech.
The rapid-fire speech part, you're probably right to critique. It's probably in some ways an appendage and maybe in the end the least useful part of the activity. I went to law school, and you always feel, well, gosh, I was a debater in college. And, you know, you go to law school and you think, well, I'm gonna be miles ahead of everybody else. But it turns out not exactly so, because the kind of argument you're trained in this policy style is so weird in some ways. The format is so unusual. The speed is so rapid. that it's strikingly unlike the kinds of skills you would use either in law school or even before a judge.
Well, especially if it's sort of prompting you to make as many arguments as possible, regardless of how, you know, regardless of their quality, I guess.
That's a good point, too. That's another debate strategy that's sometimes used. At the upper echelons, that's less true. The quality of the arguments become better and better. But it is true at the lower end, there are plenty of poorer teams that try to simply just overload you with a number of poor but voluminous arguments.
Now, were there any of these kids that you focused on that you really couldn't identify with at all? Ooh, a stumper.
You know, I have to say I did actually identify with almost all of them in many ways, because the whole culture attracts this kind of argumentative kid. And I think we all know a kid like this in our lives. And if you don't know a kid like this in your life, it's you. You're that kid. And it's the kid who always, no matter what, needs to be right. He has a certain chip on his shoulder, and he has something to prove. And unfortunately, he is actually right a great majority of the time, and that only makes him less popular than he otherwise would have been if he were just wrong a little bit. And I thought a lot of those kids had that quality to them, and I have to concede that I had, and maybe still have, you know, that sort of weakness, that vice myself. So I could identify certainly with these kids.
Now, I have a theory based on just my personal life and friends that I have where it doesn't really matter whether you're actually right. It matters. It's sort of a Costanzaism, actually. It's whether you believe that to be the truth. If you speak something with the conviction that that is the truth, people are more likely to believe you than if you're like, well, I'm pretty sure this is true. No, if you just say X is true, people will be like, okay, well, so-and-so said X is true, so does that apply here too?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is not uncommon. This is sort of the Sarah Palin effect.
Toads are actually from the moon.
You heard it here.
Yes, that's right. Oh, okay. That explains a lot.
You heard it here first. And it's an example of the important psychological component, I think, of argument in general and debate in particular. Debate is really largely a psychological game because it is, notwithstanding what I just said previously, it is fundamentally about persuading others to believe what you believe. And if you sound like you're right and you're correct, it's much easier for an objective or non-objective third party to believe you.
Well, I think we should take a break to remind people that this is the CalEx fundraiser, and you are listening to Film Close-Ups. So when you started making this film, did you have any inkling of how this actual national finals would go down at all?
I didn't have a serious idea as to how it was going to go down. The strongest contenders were from Michigan State and from Harvard, from Dartmouth and Berkeley. That year actually had a very strong team, perhaps the strongest team it had ever had in the history of the university competing in that particular forum. As to who was going to win, Harvard was the favored that year.
Right. It seemed like they had just been on a winning streak. But it's hard to watch these. I mean, I think one problem for me is it's hard to understand who's winning, you know, other than when they when they pronounce a judgment at the end and you find out who just won. But I think what I see is a problem for this kind of style of debate is just that it's not accessible to outside people because they can't understand what's going on. And I'm actually just amazed that the other team can understand what they're saying and actually come up with relatively cogent arguments while someone is just like blathering and almost hyperventilating. I mean, I was scared for them.
Right. Well, to help you understand how they do this, the first thing you have to realize is that much of the debate is written down. Now, to you, from a viewer's perspective, you're just hearing it, but they're they're actually trading their documents back and forth, and so they don't actually have to rely upon hearing the arguments. Much of it is written. It's a cheat. But that is what happens when you start to argue at a high speed, is that it's not coherent to most people. The second thing is that they're using a very specialized kind of shorthand technical jargon that you're not going to be familiar with. But as you got, if you were to become more familiar with it, then it would become less obtuse, less difficult to understand. This, I have to say, was one of the big challenges in making the film. On the one hand, you could err on the side of just dumbing it down entirely and just make the entire documentary about character, kind of like the presidential debates. It's not about the policy. You don't have to understand about international relations. You don't really have to understand any deep analysis about the healthcare system. You just like the fact that Sarah Palin is kind of shiny, and Barack Obama, he's scary and has a scary middle name. And that's one way you could have approached this documentary. And there actually has been a few attempts, I call them reality TV shows, by some networks to do a documentary about debate, and they treated it basically that way. It was all about personality, not the debate. I felt that was a cop-out. Mm-hmm. I felt that was lazy, and it wasn't demanding enough of the audience and didn't really take the audience's intellect seriously. The other extreme you could have gone to is that you could have just made it pure, raw debate with very little explanation, and you would have lost basically the entire audience except anybody who was involved in debate. So that was clearly not the way you could go either. So I took some sort of middle ground where I tried as much as I felt was feasible to explain the terms and rules of the game, to explain the terms of any particular debate, to provide on-screen motion graphic effects to help people understand the words that were being spoken. But I tried not to do it at the expense of the heart of the narrative, which was, in the end, it's really about a complicated debate. And I'm going to lose some people, and I'm going to pick up some people, and not everyone's going to get everything, and I feel that's fine. In the same way that not everyone understands episodes of ER or all the technical jargon that's happening in the operating room, people are to some extent tolerant if there's an important story there, if there's characters they like, and that was sort of the middle ground I tried to stake out. Not everyone's going to, I'm not going to bring everyone along, but hopefully enough people that the project's a success at that level.
Well, I think this film will appeal in the same way that a documentary film about a competition would, too. It doesn't really matter what the competition is. You just sort of, because you're dealing with, you know, four different teams that are doing the same thing, you sort of develop a relationship with them even though you've never met them, because you're making judgments based on what they're saying and what you perceive as their personality. And so you're rooting for someone, or maybe you're a Cal graduate, and so you're rooting for the Cal team, or, you know, if you went to Michigan State, you're rooting for them. But I think that, you know, it's on that level, it's definitely going to be accessible to anyone, because you'll just be involved in that.
I hope so. And to the University of California students and alumni listening right now, I'm not going to give away the ending, but I will tell you that if you see the movie playing here at the Shattuck Theater, Shattuck Cinema, November 2nd, Sunday night at 9:30, or if you buy the DVD at www.debateteamdocumentary.com, you will not be disappointed. I can't say more than that. The competition question is very interesting, because there have been a lot of movies and documentaries that follow this format. Spellbound is the most popular one, where you follow a bunch of kids, they're competing, who's going to win, and then somebody wins, and bam, they're the winner. It's kind of, I call it the Karate Kid framework.
Yeah.
It's the triumph over adversity. And I think this has been done more than a few times. It's kind of a Disneyfication of a story. It's feel good. It's miracle. You know, it's the 1984 American hockey team versus the Soviet Union.
Right.
And we've seen this story more than a few times. I was trying, to whatever extent I could, to tell a story that was a little bit different than that one, because it's so easy to fall into that framework, since, like as you noted, it is a competition. So one way in which I try to tell a slightly different version of this narrative is, instead of focusing on the winners as much of the as most of these stories tend to focus on, I try to give the losers equal time, if not more time. And the reason for that was at least partially because, again, I was sick of the hackneyed and cliched story from a structural level. But even philosophically, I always thought and continue to think that being a loser in some ways is the more perennial experience for us. Very few of us win national tournaments. Very few of us get into the top college of our choice or get the top job of our dreams or marry the most popular girl in school. Most of us, in every day of our lives, in small things and in big ways, have to settle for second, third, and fourth place. And I think that's because it's the more important human experience, can speak more broadly to an important aspect of who we are.
So, finally, where is this film? Is this film going to also be playing at the Roxy before the DocFest ends there?
It played at the Roxy. It's not playing at the Roxy anymore. Its run at the Roxy is over. You can see it at the Shattuck Cinema not this Sunday, but rather the Sunday after this one, November 2nd, 9:30 in the evening. We'll be giving away free DVDs and some prizes. And I encourage University of California kids to show up. It will be a good time.
I wanted to interject. Did you see the indie feature from last year called Rocket Science?
I did see Rocket Science.
Yeah, and just what you're saying about the different structures and the way that a movie like yours might cue expectations that you're going to see a certain kind of movie. I thought Rocket Science was a really good example of cueing expectations that you're going to see a triumph over adversity, and then doing what you say you sought out to do, to focus on the other side or to focus on these, you know, the alternative things that could happen. You know, you think you're going to see one thing and then it throws you curveballs consistently.
Rocket Science gets props for the unforeseen ending. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mad props. I think. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me, Sonia and Greg.
You're very welcome.
You are listening to KALX Berkeley, 90.7 FM. This is the program Film Close-Ups.